Hello, book lovers. I'm Rachel Barenbaum, author of the novel Atomic Anna. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I write novels, and on this show, I get to do one of my favorite things in the world, talk to other writers about their brand new books. And if you're like me, and you get tired of seeing the same titles on every bestseller list, you are in the right place, because on this show, you'll hear from authors who aren't famous yet, but probably will be. Remember, you heard them here first. Today, Rebecca Lehman and her brand new debut novel, The Beheading Game. This book is a ghost story told by a ghost, the ghost of Anne Boleyn. Anne Boleyn was Henry VIII's second wife. She was beheaded. What if she woke up after her execution, sewed her head back on, and then took it upon herself to seek justice? Well, Rebecca Lehman is going to talk to us all about that story. Rebecca, I'm so excited to have you here on the show. Welcome to Check This Out.
Thank you, Rachel. It's so wonderful to be here. I'm excited to talk.
So there's a lot going on in your debut novel, The Beheading Game. It's a ghost story told by Anne Boleyn. Can you start us off with some history? I thought you wrote this amazing preface and you gave sort of a summary of Anne Boleyn's life and what she was like. Could you read that for us so that we can be situated in history?
Sure, absolutely.
I mean, Henry VIII had a lot of wives, so I want to make sure we're all talking about the right one.
He absolutely did. And you know what? I am an American, so I didn't learn a lot of this stuff in history class as a kid. So it was very important to me to get the history right. Okay, so I'll go ahead and read the prologue to the book, which gives a little bit of history and kind of frames up what is happening just before the novel starts. On May 19, 1536, Anne Boleyn, King Henry VIII's second wife, was executed by beheading at the Tower of London for the alleged crimes of adultery, incest, and high treason. Five men, accused of being her lovers, had been executed 2 days earlier: Sir Henry Norris, Sir Francis Weston, William Brereton, the court musician Mark Smeaton, and Anne's own brother, George Boleyn. Anne and Henry courted for 7 years as he negotiated an annulment from his first wife, Catherine of Aragon, with whom he had one surviving child, the Princess Mary. The conflict over the great matter of Henry's annulment ultimately led to England's break with the Catholic Church in Rome, setting the nation on a path toward Protestantism. After their long courtship, Anne and Henry were married for only 3 years, during which time Anne was almost constantly pregnant, as Henry grew increasingly desperate for a male heir. Anne gave birth to one daughter, the Princess Elizabeth. Her other pregnancies ended in miscarriage, including the late miscarriage of a baby boy in January 1536. Less than 4 months later, Anne Boleyn was beheaded. At the time of Anne's execution, Henry had been openly involved in a months-long affair with her lady-in-waiting Jane Seymour. Anne was the first, though not last, English queen to be executed.
All right. Thank you, Rebecca, for reading the prologue to your debut novel, The Beheading Game. So this is a ghost story. We are talking about the ghost of Anne Boleyn, and she's just been beheaded when the book opens. So tell us, what is the book about?
Okay. So the book is obviously about Anne Boleyn, and it has kind of a wild premise wherein she wakes up several hours after her execution. It's the middle of the night. She is in the arrow chest in which she was buried, which is kind of a heartbreaking detail about Anne Boleyn's execution. It was planned out to the T by Henry VIII and Thomas Cromwell, but they didn't plan for any place to put the body afterwards. And so they just kind of grabbed something that was available, which was an arrow chest, which would have been used to store arrows for hunting. And she fit in the chest because she had been beheaded, and so she was shorter. So she wakes up in the arrow chest, and she's very disoriented, and she comes to realize that she has been beheaded, but she has come back to life. And she's not really sure why or how. That's not something that gets explained in the novel. There's no moment where, for example, like the Lady of the Lake comes up and is like, here's how it's all working. She just has to ride with this uncertainty And she escapes from the Tower of London, sews her head back on, and then goes on a quest to kill Henry VIII before he can marry his next wife, Jane Seymour, because she really wants to protect her own daughter Elizabeth's claim to the throne. She knows that Henry is going to marry Jane quickly, and she wants to prevent him from fathering another child who could put her own daughter's claim to the throne at risk.
This is just wild. I have to say this again. So Anne Boleyn wakes up in an arrow chest. She picks up her head, right? And then she finds a sewing basket eventually and sews her head back on. And then she's out in the world, the ghost of Anne Boleyn.
Yes, that's right. And Anne, you know, like Anne was a very, I think, capable and clever person. So she actually steals a sewing basket from a tavern keeper's wife who is sleeping. She kind of like prowls into her house and steals it from her while she's slumbering so she can get her head back on.
So this is a wild book, and we're going to really dig into it over the course of this interview. But like on the surface, it's about, you know, Anne Boleyn's ghost coming back and, you know, she's out to kill Henry. But what is it really about to you? Why dig into this story? What are you really trying to get at?
Yeah, so I was always really bothered by the story of Anne Boleyn. I think that she's often simplified and kind of miscast in pop culture representations and even some literary representations. Like I really love the Wolf Hall books by Hilary Mantel, for example. I think she kind of does the same thing. Her project is not to write about Anne Boleyn, so I'll forgive her that. Her project is to write about Thomas Cromwell, but she's often simplified as this sort of like two-dimensional character who is an oversexed homewrecker who uses her sexuality to get what she wants, breaks up Henry VIII's first marriage, and then the moral of Anne Boleyn's story is usually something along the lines of, well, she got what she deserved when she was beheaded. She always seemed to me to be this really like magnetic and charismatic person. And I thought there has to be more. And it doesn't take much research at all to realize that Anne Boleyn was actually a very smart person. She spoke multiple languages. She was really savvy at politics. She was a true believer in the Protestant Reformation and really guided Henry VIII's hand into splitting with Rome. And not just because she wanted to marry him, but because she really believed in that cause. So the more I looked into her, the more I thought, I really want to retell her story. I really want to give her a better ending. And I also want to examine what happened to her. Like, how did she go from this beloved queen consort in this passionate relationship with a young king to the scaffold in a matter of 3 years? Like, what went wrong there?
One of the things that you really had to be aware of as you were writing this book, I'm sure, was what is real history, right? Like, what really happened as far as you can tell versus what am I completely making up? And one thing that was very clear in the book is that Anne Boleyn was, almost everyone agrees, innocent of all the charges that she was found guilty
yes.
of. And yet there are all these grand stories told about her being, you know, promiscuous and all of these horrible things attributed to her. Let's talk about that.
I found that very jarring when I was researching her, because I think that the two things don't quite gel up, you know, like most historians today agree that she was innocent of these charges. And yet this myth persists that she was this promiscuous woman. And I think it has a lot to do with the way that she was tried and this kind of like ongoing character assassination that happened in the years following her execution. Like Henry VIII wanted to seem like he had left this marriage for a good reason, executed his wife for good cause. And so these stories persist. But I also think that casting her as sexually promiscuous and somebody who got what she deserves is a story that fit into the patriarchal culture of the time and unfortunately has like continued to echo for the same reason across 500 years of history.
So one thing, I find this absolutely fascinating, and one thing that has always bothered me about Anne Boleyn and stories around her, and was in your novel too, is that Anne follows, she's the second wife. So the first wife was Catherine.
Yes.
And Catherine was married first to Henry's brother before Henry died. And so Anne is being maligned and, you know, all these horrible things are being said about her. And yet she's saying horrible things about Catherine, too, right? She's sort of making that you know, myth continue. Let's talk about that for a while. What do you think about that?
I found that really interesting. And I think from a contemporary perspective, you know, like I teach gender and women's studies at a college, and so I'm very familiar with like the trappings of contemporary feminism. I think we might look back on that and be like, why were those women so mean to each other? Why were they pitted against each other? Why couldn't they support each other? But they were also just people. And Catherine of Aragon really felt like she had the rightful claim to be Queen of England. But Anne bought, hook, line, and sinker, bought Henry VIII's story that because Catherine had been married to his brother first, they had had to get a dispensation from the Pope to wed each other, because at that time it was considered incest to marry your sibling's widow if the marriage had been consummated. And so Catherine of Aragon and Henry VIII had both like signed affidavits or whatever, saying that the marriage hadn't been consummated between Catherine and his older brother, Arthur. And then all these years later, no male heir, Henry suddenly starts saying, oh, no, 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 they totally consummated the marriage. That's why we haven't been able to have a male heir. This marriage is incestuous and illegal. And Anne really believed that. And so I think that she thought that she was doing the right thing. She was going to help Henry get out of this incestuous marriage. She was going to marry him, usher in a new era in England, provide the male heir. I don't know that she looked at it in terms of gender herself, but I think from a contemporary perspective, it's easy to think like, why couldn't these women just join together and oust this man? But they had so few independent rights at this time.
Right. And really what we see, what you make clear in your debut novel, The Beheading Game, is that this is really also a fight for survival, right? Like Henry himself feels like he's fighting to survive. He needs an heir in order to survive. And Anne's like literally trying to keep her head on her shoulders, right?
Yeah.
And so it's not, you know, there's like this highfalutin view of like, can't all women be nice to each other and hold yourselves up? But then there's also like, how am I going to survive?
Absolutely. You know, and I'll also say, like, no one ever says to men, why can't you be nice to each other and just hold each other up? You know, I think that that's a little bit of a double standard that gets applied to women. I'm all for solidarity amongst women, but I do think that nobody, again, no one asks that about men.
Yes. I love that you're pointing that out. Thank you. So speaking of, this brings me to my next question, which is that Anne Boleyn, you mentioned earlier, it seems like she was whip smart, right? Like super, super smart. And at one point in your ghost story, you even mentioned that she thought that Henry wanted to marry her so that they could rule together, like as much for her brain as for any other attributes that she had. Was that real? Like, did he really, was there historical evidence that he wanted to rule with her?
There were things about Anne Boleyn that I had to imagine, but this is not one of them. There is absolutely historical evidence that he was attracted to her intelligence and wanted to co-lead England with her. As they were courting, for example, she was feeding him passages of these books that had been banned in England, William Tyndale's Obedience of a Christian Man and the English translation of the Bible. And she was like highlighting passages for him to look at that pertained to like the rule of kings and how popes should not be a thing. And then when she was crowned with St. Edward the Confessor's crown, which is a crown that's usually reserved for people born into royalty, not people who are marrying into the family. And so there was a lot of evidence that he was setting her up to be this like co-monarch with him. But then that turned around really fast because he had all the power. So he could promise her anything that he wanted. But at the end of the day, he was the one that was making all of those decisions.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. And my guest today is Rebecca Lehman. We are talking about her brand new debut novel, The Beheading Game. It's a ghost story about Anne Boleyn, and it's told from Anne's perspective. I really want to dig in to Anne Boleyn, the mythology, the mythos. Like, why are we so obsessed with her? Why? This was 1536, and it feels like we can't stop talking about her. Why?
I know. You know, I thought a lot about this, like, why are people drawn to her? And I really think a big part of it is that she's an example of a woman who gained a lot of power and then, as a consequence, was kind of punished for that power. And, you know, I think that that echoes into today. Like, fortunately, powerful women are not beheaded in contemporary American culture or British culture. But I do think that we can all recognize elements of that story in women who ascend to a certain level of power or leadership. And then when something goes wrong, become the scapegoat, take the blame, have really precipitous falls. That's something to me in the Anne Boleyn story that I saw and thought, I recognize that from contemporary culture. And I think I'm not the only one who sees that. Also, I think because now we all surmise that these charges were false, it's just such an odious example of something unfair in history. And it can be kind of satisfying to like look at that and think about the ways that it was unfair.
Yeah, and I guess also because King Henry VIII did have 6 wives.
Yeah, there's a little bit something of like a soap opera about the Tudor dynasty. There's so many ins and outs, and this person is married to that person, and this person had this many wives, and the princes in the tower are kidnapped and then disappear. It reminded me a little bit of like All My Children or something sometimes when I was doing this research.
Yes. All right, let's talk about the fact that this is a ghost story told by a ghost. And there are many, many fairy tales layered into your debut novel, The Beheading Game. Let's talk about fairy tales and what they're doing in there. Can you tell me how that influenced the book and how you think about them in the novel?
Yeah, so there are 3 fairy tales in the book. There's one early on in the book that Anne's brother tells to her in an imagined scene when they're children, and Anne is sick with a fever. And the fairy tale that he tells her is the English version of Bluebeard. So it's called Mr. Fox, but it's a very similar theme where there's a dastardly man trying to marry this young woman, and she figures out that he's like serially marrying women and then murdering them. In the Mr. Fox story, her male relatives, after she reveals him, her male relatives cut him up to pieces. And so there's a bit of a happy ending. And then in the middle of the novel, there's a version of the Grimm brothers' tale, The Golden Bird. And I think that in that story, what I was really drawn to is that there's a character who dies and comes back to life, which obviously echoes with the novel that I've written. And then at the very end of the novel, there's a 3rd fairy tale that Anne gets to tell in her own voice. And that one is completely made up. I wrote that fairy tale for the novel. And that I saw as this moment where Anne could really talk about what had happened to her and reframe it in a way that makes sense to her.
And why fairy tales in a ghost story?
Well, I love fairy tales. I have 2 young kids, and so I'm kind of living in the realm of fairy tale myself with bedtime stories. And my kids really love fairy tales. And I think that one thing about fairy tales that's very interesting, especially if you dig past the Disney version of fairy tales, is that they're often really gruesome. And they have these like weird lessons, and people come back from the dead frequently in fairy tales. And I thought about fairy tales as a way that wisdom used to be passed down from generation to generation in these sort of like allegorical systems. And I just thought, because Anne is relatively young when she's executed, she's like in her 30s, she would be thinking back on her life and remembering some of these moments where she's like encountered these strange stories that perhaps can frame up what's happening to her.
And I thought they also echoed the gruesomeness of her death.
Absolutely.
Every little detail was planned about her execution and that horrible, you know, she's actually beheaded and thrown in an arrow.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And there was something to these executions in this time period, these beheading executions. They were very much about the spectacle of the event, you know, like an audience gathers, the person gives a speech, there's a dramatic beheading. It was a very violent time.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. My guest today is Rebecca Lehman, and we are talking about her brand new debut novel, The Beheading Game. I absolutely love this ghost story within a ghost story. It is the ghost story of Anne Boleyn. She is beheaded, and then she comes back to life, sews her head on, and she goes out into the world. And what comes up again and again are fairy tales. We talked about that a little bit before. And what comes up a lot is the legend of Arthur and Lancelot. They come up again and again. Let's talk about that. Why is that woven into this book?
there are many references to Arthurian legend in this book. There's some references to the story of Gawain and the Green Knight, where Gawain beheads the magical Green Knight, and then the Green Knight says, I'll see you in a year when I'm going to behead you back. Gawain gallantly shows up to his own beheading, and because he's so chivalrous, he just gets a nick on the neck. That story really resonated with the story that I wanted to tell about Anne Boleyn in terms of this magical element of someone being beheaded and being able to keep living. And there's a whole like tradition of those types of head carrier stories where somebody comes back from the dead. But the story of Arthur and Guinevere and Lancelot also really resonated with me around this story for a couple of reasons. One, Henry VIII was absolutely obsessed with King Arthur, and he and his father had these like elaborate family trees drawn up to try to link the Tudor dynasty to King Arthur as though he were a real person, which they believed he was a real person. So they wanted to like establish their legitimacy by connecting themselves to this legend of a king. But also the story of King Arthur and Guinevere and Lancelot has this adulterous thread in it, where does Guinevere have this affair with Lancelot or not? How does Arthur react to that? And I thought that that had some really obvious resonance with the story of Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII and Henry VIII accusing her of adultery when she probably did not do that. And so I wanted to pull some of those threads of English myth into the story.
But also you sort of mirror the fact that this is a ghost story, and Henry himself was always looking to the ghost story of King Arthur throughout his reign.
And it was something that he really believed in, yeah, and kind of like looked to as a model.
Okay, so in your debut novel, The Beheading Game, we are with, we're front row center, right, with Anne Boleyn, her ghost, and she wakes up, she sews her head back on, and she goes out and has this sort of adventure. And we meet this character, Alice. I love Alice. You entirely made her up, I understand.
And yes, she's completely fabricated.
And we get to see a whole other part of London, of England in the moment. Tell us about Alice.
So Alice is a part-time sex worker in Southwark, which is like, at the time, was a seedy southern suburb of London. Today, it's just part of London proper. But Anne wakes up in the Tower, flees across the River Thames, ends up in Southwark, and then kind of gets into a scrape. And Alice saves her from that scrape. She's a commoner. She's grown up in the Fens in northern England, which is this swampy wetland that's drained shortly after this time period. And people from the Fens were really looked down upon. So she has this sort of, she's a very strong personality. I really love writing her. And she kind of serves as this counterweight to Anne. The two develop a friendship, and then that blossoms into something a little more as the novel goes on.
Yeah, I mean, they fall in love. And we see a whole other side of Anne Boleyn imagined, right? Because her whole life she's sort of been stuck in this tower, in this, you're right, you must be this kind of woman. And all of a sudden she loses her head, she throws it back on, and she sees this whole other life through Alice. And I just thought that was a beautiful way to bring it in. Like, you don't just have to love, you know, Henry. There are other people in the world that you could love and that you could be with, and you could have children in your life.
Yes, because that they do return at one point in the novel to Alice's home. And then Anne discovers that she has a couple of children herself. She's also a mother. And I really, that was really important to me. I wanted to like show this other choice that Anne could make. Like, she could go down another path and have peace and maybe happiness and come into a relationship on more equal footing with somebody who respects her and who is not like the king who has absolute power over her.
What was fantastic about Alice and this part of the story is it's very easy to look back on Anne Boleyn and Henry VIII and the soap opera of the Tudor dynasty, right? And see, you know, the opulence, the beauty of being in a castle. Yes, it was hard because you could be beheaded, but you're eating, right, fancy foods and wearing beautiful dresses. And we don't often see this other side of 1536 England, where you're asking questions, you know, what is it to be independent? What is it to make your own way in the world? As a woman, as someone in the Fens, right, you showed us a whole different side of that life. You must have really dug into a lot of research to figure all of that out, right? That was very different from the Anne Boleyn side.
Absolutely. And I loved doing that because, as you said, I think when we look back on the Tudor time period, we really focus on the nobility and the royalty. And those stories are lovely and very fun to dig into. And there's the soap opera element that's very interesting. But there were so many other people alive in Tudor England who just led normal lives. And so what were those lives like was a big question that I had. What would the lives of commoners have been like? I also think there's often the misconception that common people in this time period were just happily going along with the way that things were and very pleased with monarchy and kind of like top-down rule and just having these like idyllic peasant lives. But in fact, there were like peasant revolts were very common during this time period. And I don't think that everyday people were particularly pleased with how things were shaking out. And that's a viewpoint that Alice gets to share with Anne during their encounters.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. My guest today is Rebecca Lehman, and we are talking about her brand new debut novel, The Beheading Game. Let's dig in a little bit more to people that were around Anne, because another one of these figures that we hear about a lot, especially after Hilary Mantel, is Cromwell himself. So he makes an appearance, of course, in The Beheading Game. We have the ghost of Anne Boleyn comes back and she tracks him down. She finds him and she has a conversation with him. Talk to us about Cromwell and how you see him fitting into Anne's life.
I really wanted her to, at some point in the novel, run into Cromwell. And she does toward the end of the book. And I don't want to give too much away about that, but they do have a meeting and they get to kind of come head to head. In real life, I think Anne and Cromwell started off as allies. They were both supporters of the Protestant Reformation. They had a lot of common goals, but I think that they sought to occupy the same role in Henry VIII's life. Like Cromwell was one of his biggest advisors, and Anne comes in as the second wife who also wants to be his biggest advisor. And they had a lot of disagreements. Cromwell, Henry VIII, and this cast of noblemen who were kind of taking apart the Catholic Church in England were mostly pocketing the proceeds of that endeavor. Like there was a lot of wealth in the Catholic Church. Anne wanted to see that money go toward projects that she thought of as being beneficial to all of England, like funding universities, funding hospitals, like put that money back out to the people to a certain extent. And that was a big disagreement that the two of them had. Shortly before she was executed, she had one of her preachers preach this like big sermon about, it was kind of a coded sermon about how greedy Cromwell was. And I think that that was a move that probably did not help her out because unbeknownst to her, he was already building this case, this legal case against her. And that certainly did not help him feel more charitable toward her.
At one point, the ghost of Anne Boleyn asks, does Cromwell like women? And you take this into her head and she's like, I actually think he does like women. Like there's all this evidence that he loves women in his life. And it reframed him for me as someone, it wasn't about just, you know, getting Henry forward or himself, but it more that this was about power. Right? That he was more concerned with power than actually, like, you made me believe that he would support Anne. He would support Elizabeth to become queen, right? That's what it was about more than just, it's got to be, you know, me, myself, Henry. I liked that question a lot. Does he support women?
That's something that I thought about a lot as well. And I thought about that in a contemporary context, too. Like, you know, you encounter men sometimes who seem to be really misogynistic, but then you see them with their own families, with their own wives, their own daughters, and clearly they love those women. So how do you square that circle? How do you like make those two things compute? And Cromwell treated the women in his life with a lot of respect. So how do you make those two things add up? And I do think at the end of the day, the conclusion that I headed toward was, as you said, that he was mostly interested in power. And I don't know that the gender mattered much to him when it came to thinking about power. He wanted to be close to power and he wanted to help steer power in England.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. We spoke to Janet Rich Edwards about her debut novel, Canticle, last season. That novel has since been longlisted for the Carol Shields Prize for Fiction. Congratulations, Janet. If you haven't read her book yet, Canticle, check it out and listen to the episode wherever you get your podcasts or on nhpr.org. My guest today is Rebecca Lehman, and we are talking about her brand new debut novel, The Beheading Game. This is a novel about the ghost of Anne Boleyn. She comes back to life after she's been beheaded. She sews her head back on, that's right, and then she goes out as the ghost. So earlier in this interview, we talked about how there are lots of fairy tales and stories around Anne Boleyn. As her ghost is out in the world and people start to recognize her in the book, all sorts of new fairy tales or ghost stories arise. And this myth that she is from the devil or promiscuous or a horrible person lingers and grows, right? And these gross exaggerations of what people are seeing start coming out. Let's talk about that and how she continues to be maligned even after she's dead.
I know, it's so galling. You know, when I first started diving into the research about this novel, about The Beheading Game, I would encounter these totally made up rumors about her, like she had a sixth finger, or she had a giant wen on her neck, or she was a witch. And I think that those are, again, the product of like that character assassination that happened against her right after she was executed, but they're really pernicious stories. And so I wanted to really engage with that in the novel and think about, why are people saying these things? And what effect would it have had for her to be listening to them? You know, because as this woman who's back from the dead, hearing some of these stories get repeated about herself really chips away at her confidence and the way that she feels about how the people of England felt about her.
And one of the things that you brought up, you know, sort of as people were saying all of these awful things about her, you sort of weave in the facts about the last 3 years of her life, which was basically she was pregnant all the time. So she had one full term pregnancy that led to Elizabeth, who becomes Queen Elizabeth, arguably the greatest monarch of all times. Then she also has 3 to 4 miscarriages, one very late in the pregnancy. And so, you know, she's physically bleeding for like 3 years. And the guilt and the suffering, not to mention the hormones of going through all of these pregnancies, like that is all weighing on her. And you weave that in very subtly into the book, but we never talk about that when we talk about Anne Boleyn.
We don't, and that frustrated me so much. I feel like her status as a mother, that she was a mother, often drops out of the story about her. Like she's kind of, that she is Queen Elizabeth's mother is a little bit of a footnote in her life. And it's also a little bit of a footnote in Elizabeth's life. Like when we talk about Queen Elizabeth I, sort of like, oh yeah, and her mother was Anne Boleyn, but we're not going to talk about that very much. We're just going to frame her as Henry VIII's third daughter, as though she just like sprang out of his head, like Athena out of Zeus's head or something. That really frustrated me because she did spend so much of her queenship either pregnant and giving birth to Elizabeth, or pregnant with this series of pregnancies that ended in miscarriage. And I just thought, as a mother myself, I thought about how exhausting and harrowing pregnancy is. And I thought about how much that would have worn her down and just kind of like ground her into the dirt to a certain extent.
Yeah, I mean, the pure exhaustion of going through that many pregnancies, losing them, you know, giving birth, all of that, right? We never talk about that around her ghost. And we get to see that in this book when she comes back to life. And we see it with Alice. I felt like Alice, who becomes a love interest for Anne, sort of recognizes for the first time, like, maybe there's a lot more here to Anne Boleyn than I ever knew.
Absolutely. You know, I think that because Alice is also a mother, she can see those sides of the story as well. She can understand what it's like to be pregnant, what it's like to give birth, what it's like to bleed for a couple of months afterwards, to deal with those hormonal crashes, to deal with not having a lot of energy, and then to just sort of also deal with like the way that in this time period, men had so much power over women, and men could really dispose of women. part of Alice's backstory is that she's been kind of married off to this older man to settle some of her family's debts. And he has since met his end in a different way that she's not very sad about in the novel. But she can relate to Anne's experiences as a wife and mother.
If you're just joining us, I'm Rachel Barenbaum. My guest today is Rebecca Lehman. We are talking about her brand new debut novel, The Beheading Game. And you are listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. Rebecca, let's circle back in The Beheading Game, your new novel. We are in the middle of a ghost story told from the perspective of the ghost of Anne Boleyn. And it starts out sort of matter-of-factly, like she wakes up, she sews her head back on, and she goes out into the world. And obviously that's like a ghost story, that's a fairy tale, but it turns into a bigger fairy tale as you move along. And we, for example, meet a white bull. And this white bull becomes Anne Boleyn's ghost's protector and sort of follower. So let's talk about the role of the bull and the green man and how this fairy tale just expands as we dive deeper and deeper into your novel.
The big magical element in the novel is that she comes back from the dead, sews her head back on, and can keep going. But there are a couple of other threads that pop up in the book where things that seem magical start happening. And one is this white bull that shows up as she is kind of like lost in the woods. She wakes up and this bull is standing over her, breathing down upon her. One of the emblems for the Boleyn family was a bull. And so I wanted to pull in that image of the bull and think about what if I could turn that into like this physical incarnation of an actual animal that she gets to have with her and that gets to kind of help her on her journey. And she actually starts riding the bull through the woods and the bull gets her out of a scrape as they go forward. I thought about the bull as maybe like a little bit of a physical incarnation of her brother, George, who does not come back to life in the novel, but who she loved dearly and misses pretty awfully during this whole narrative.
But for me, it really like built it into more and more of a fairy tale ghost story, right? Before it was kind of like, okay, her head's sewn back on, but otherwise she's just a normal woman who's very thirsty and very tired, right?
Absolutely. But fairy tales often have animal helpers, right? And yeah. So I was thinking of that element as well. Like here's the animal helper that's going to come to her aid.
Yes. And so then this bull comes to aid her in her quest for revenge. She's out to kill Henry VIII, you know, her husband who had her beheaded. But at the same time, she wants to make sure that her daughter, Elizabeth, becomes queen. So she has these sort of dueling or maybe, you know, parallel desires that are really fueling her. And I just couldn't decide. I was like, what did she want more? Or what did she maybe what Anne Boleyn really wanted was her own legacy, right? It's really about her own power continuing through her daughter. So it wasn't like this motherly, cute, packaged, I want to save my daughter. It's like, I want to save my legacy and my future. Or do I want revenge? How did you think about that?
I think that this can be a yes and situation. Like she wants both things and she should be able to have them. And they are intertwined because protecting her daughter is going to protect her legacy. Like the real Anne Boleyn wanted to help usher the Renaissance into England and had these really grand plans. And in the novel, by protecting Elizabeth and situating her to ascend to the throne, she thinks that her legacy is going to be able to continue. And she also loves her daughter dearly. Like Elizabeth was a gifted child. She was very precocious, even during the time that Anne Boleyn knew her, because she was not quite three when Anne was executed. And she wants to just like give her the best, you know, and get her up there on the throne.
Yeah. So it's a both and situation.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, this whole sort of era of the Tudors is this obsession over heirs and who's going to be next and how is my legacy going to be cemented. And I feel like you can't talk about Anne Boleyn or Henry VIII or any of the wives without talking about that.
Yeah, absolutely. There was so much anxiety over who would inherit the throne. And some of that comes from Henry's father having come into power at the tail end of the War of the Roses. And there's just so much anxiety about it. And Henry's older brother dies of a fever. So he's initially the spare, not the heir. And he just wants like a bench of male children that he can draw from to continue his legacy, which he doesn't get. I think like it's so ironic that this is a man that spends his life worrying about having a son, and he's best known for his wives and daughters.
Yes, the incredible Queen Elizabeth who comes next.
Yes.
All right, let's switch gears a little bit. You are a poet. First and foremost, you've published several volumes of poetry, and most recently you published a volume called The Sweating Sickness, which was a sickness, right, contemporary to Anne Boleyn, still sort of a medical mystery, I understand. How does your poetry influence this debut novel, The Beheading Game?
Well, I think that one way that it does so is that I have been writing Anne Boleyn kind of into like the corners of poems for years before I started this novel. I just had this like kind of low-key obsession with her. She was never really the main character, but she would sort of just show up in the periphery of poems here and there. But The Sweating Sickness, which is my most recent volume of poetry, I was writing many of the poems in it concurrent to writing the novel. And so there are a few poems in the book that speak directly to Anne Boleyn and where she takes center stage.
And so are you now going to stick to novels? Are you going back to poetry? Like, what are we looking at as your trajectory as a writer?
Such a tough question. I think this is also a yes and situation. I would like to do both, but writing novels takes a tremendous amount of time and focus. And so I am still writing poetry, but at a slower rate than I used to. I really loved writing this novel, and I'm working on a second novel now. I think I've been bitten by the bug.
I love it. But it feels like poetry comes from a different part of your brain than novels do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It does feel like two very different experiences to sit down and write a poem. And one thing that stands out to me is that when I sit down to write a poem, at least, if I have like a 4 or 5 hour chunk and I'm really focused, I can get a good first draft of a poem out. And it's a complete object. And that's very satisfying to be like, this is the whole thing. I don't have to think about which chapter goes where or a larger narrative arc. This is a complete object. Novels are so different than that. Of course, it's this long marathon. It takes a really long time to write the first draft. And then each subsequent revision is also very time intensive. And it's hard to hold the whole thing in your head at one time. But I do enjoy writing both. So I don't know that I'm going to stop writing poetry, but it has slowed down a little.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm ready for either. I understand that you teach writing, and you don't believe in one size fits all craft advice.
Yeah.
But I still want to ask you if you have some advice for new writers or aspiring writers out there.
The biggest advice that I give my students is to read really widely, you know, like see what else is out there, read contemporary writers. If you're interested in writing a certain type of novel or story or poem, find other writers that have done something similar and see what's already been done and what you can learn. And then I also talk to my students a lot about just sitting down and doing the work, especially for those that are working on longer pieces like novels. And I do get some undergraduate students who are working on novel projects. Like, a lot of it is sitting down, making a schedule, making sure that you get your butt in the chair and that you work on your writing. But then in the classroom, I try to tailor the feedback that I give them to the projects that they're working on, because what one student sees as a challenge or is having as a writing challenge might be totally different from someone else.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's great advice, because you can't be a writer unless you write, unless you sit down and do the work.
It's so true. That's maybe one of the only universal pieces of advice that I can give. Like, I teach craft books and we talk about craft in the classes that I teach. But, you know, there's like such a variety, even among novels and the types of novels that are written, and what might be important to one writer versus another writer can be totally different things.
Rebecca Lehman, thank you so much for joining me today. I absolutely loved talking to you about your debut novel, The Beheading Game.
Thank you so much, Rachel. It's been a delight.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum, author of the novels A Bend in the Stars and Atomic Anna. You've been listening to Check This Out, a show where I get to do one of my favorite things in the world, talk to other writers about their brand new books. Check This Out is a partnership between New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I'll be back next week with another new author you should not miss. Our producer today is Jessica Hunt. NHPR's program director is Emily Quirk. Our partner, the Penn Faulkner Foundation's mission is to champion the breadth and power of fiction in America. The show is sponsored by CNS Wholesale Grocers family of companies, the podcast Totally Booked with Zibby and Zibby's Bookshop, and the Jack and Dorothy Byrne Foundation. Remember to go to your local library or bookstore and check out all the books we're talking about this season. Thanks so much for listening. Read on.